Welcome to my Blog Talk radio show, Love Your Music. I'm Margot Joy Denader, and I'm a creative life balance coach, singer, songwriter, and the author of The Art of Living a Life You Love. My guest for today's show is my inspiring friend, Ben Parker. Ben is an artist, speaker, and is the author of A Field Guide to the F Word. Today, we'll be talking about Ben's art, his book, and what he wants to share with us about living here on this beautiful planet we call Earth. Welcome, Ben.
Well, welcome for having me. I mean, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Oh, my gosh. I am so absolutely excited to have you on my show today. This has been a dream of mine for a long time, is to have you on to talk to my guests and listeners about all of your experiences during your 98 years on this planet. You just are just such an inspiration to me and so many other people I know, including my husband and my son and all of the people in our Toastmasters Club. You're just, you inspire us.
And well, I never dreamed I'd be an inspiration to anybody for anything.
You know what I've noticed is the people who are the most inspiring, usually that's not their, they never even dreamed of inspiring people, or they're not doing it on purpose. They're just living their life their way and doing what I call living your music, which is living what they feel called to do, what inspires them. You know, by living what you feel inspired to do, it inspires other people. That's what I've noticed. And all of the guests that I've had on my show are doing that. They're living what they feel inspired to live. So that's live your music means to do that. And you are doing it in spades, and you have been for years. So it just, you know, I know you don't understand why you inspire people, but you do. And so I just want to thank you for being an inspiration in our lives. And to start out with, I think let's talk about writing your book, A Field Guide to the F Word, which I can't even believe it. It's like you came into my life when you joined our Toastmasters Club. I believe it was in 2013. And at that time, the F word was definitely something I wanted our son to stop using. So the fact that you helped me get over that is the point I'm getting at. Because of this book and your sense of humor, it really started helping me see the F word and the use of it in such a different way. So would you tell us a little bit about the book, A Field Guide to the F Word? What inspired you to write it, and a little bit about it?
Well, a couple of things. One of them is, the book is it's humorous. I think you can, but you can flip through it in 15 minutes. But the thing that really got me interested in pursuing this was the realization that the word is in widespread use, but there really are rules for using it, and nobody seems to have noticed. So I thought I'd write a book about it. And also to state my contention that the word as we know it, and I have to stress that, mm-hmm. The word as we know it is a creation of the servicemen in World War II. Now, I discussed this with a couple of linguists, and they don't disagree with that. The proof of that is the fact that the word has existed since prior to the year 1500. That's the first time it appeared in print, I think, was 1489.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time it was in use, it was extant, highly taboo, rarely in print, and referring specifically and only to a particular physical act.
Mm-hmm.
Four centuries later, in 1900 and up into the 1930s, when I was growing up, it remained extant, highly taboo, rarely in print, and still referring to a specific act. And hell, by the 1950s, the war started in 1939, and by the time the war was over, and the post-war period out of the way, say the 1950s, snafu was a word in the American language. I think that all by itself indicates that the word got developed during World War II and by the servicemen. As far as I seem to be nattering on about it, but the book continues to fascinate me, really, the concept of it and people's response to it. And that is that, how do I put it? I lost my train of thought.
Well, you know, the word, okay, get back to snafu. You know, I had heard that my whole life, and it wasn't until I read it in your book, I had no idea how, where the word came from or what it even
well,
meant.
Well, I don't know where you've been living. I thought everybody knew that. The first time it used to be referred to politely as standing for situation normal, all fouled up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's news to me that anybody didn't know the actual word.
No, I had no idea that that's where it was from. And, you know, one of the things I do love about your book is, like you said, it's a short book. It can be read quickly. It's got definitely in an afternoon, if not sooner. But I love the illustrations, and I love the fact that in the, oh, God, was it in the introduction, it says, note to the concerned reader, the word does not actually appear in this book in the interest of saving ink.
Well, you will admit it's one hell of a challenge to write a book about a word without using the word.
Well, that's true, but I mean, that's part of what I love about the book is that instead of overusing the word like that, which is your point about the etiquette for it, you have the book every place that it would appear, there's a blank. And, you know, I mean, obviously we can fill it in our mind.
And you do as you read it, you fill it in, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. And as you found when you did your book talk in November, which is in the slideshow with you there at the table with the book. It's a challenge when you do the book talks, though, because if you read parts of the book, you have to either say blank or effing or use the word itself, whereas in the book, you've got the blank.
Yeah, it works visually. That's the way it was set up to be, and that's how it does work. It doesn't really work very effectively using something else. I think the next time I give a talk on it, if I do, I'm going to say bleep. I think that expresses the idea more clearly than say freaking or something. I'll just say bleeping.
Bleeping, that's an interesting way to do it. Yeah, I don't know. For me, even effing works because, you know, and right after, around the same time that I met you, and I'd been so upset because Xander had been posting words like that on his Facebook page, and all of the relatives and everybody all over the world was seeing this, and I was telling him, you got to get these things off the Facebook page. You're not going to be able to get a job if you have all those things on there. So then I meet you, and then Marcia in our Toastmasters club, she goes, you know, Margo, in our generation, we don't think it's that big a deal to use that word.
It's true. It's
and
true.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a lot of your point here is that it gets so overused lately.
Yes,
that it's lost the
originally
impact,
it had
right?
some shock values, but that's gone long since. It's just tacky.
Yeah, yeah, and like some of the comedians, I've found the ones that I find that are funniest are the ones that don't really ever use it because they actually use other words instead of just filling all the blanks in with that word. But the funniest thing about it, though, is that later, the show that Xander's working on now as an editor in Hollywood is called F is for Family. And when he went to apply for the job, the man that was interviewing him said, you're okay with having a few bad words in the show, aren't you? And then he says, "Mom,
I didn't know this had
me.
Gotten this way. I didn't know this had, the book had gotten this way onto Facebook. This is the first I've heard of that."
Yeah, yeah. But it was the first time that I started realizing, okay, he got, it helped him get his job. But yeah, it's a lighthearted look at the way that is, and I wish that we could, you know, we could tell people. Is there anything in particular that you want to read from there that where you could use the bleeping or the effing in it, or do you have something that you want to?
No, I don't.
Give us an example.
So I enjoyed playing with it. The thing I personally enjoyed most was using it in the nouns of collection, especially made-up ones. Do you know the nouns of collection? A gaggle of geese, a herd of cattle, and so forth. Well,
yeah. I love that part. I love that part of the book.
I'm sorry. I particularly enjoy making up nouns of collection, like a drill of dentists, and I end up with a bleat of conservatives,
mm-hmm.
and contrast that with a sulk, that is a bleeping bleep of liberals, and a bleeping sulk of conservatives. I enjoy both of those. Anyway, you get your kicks your way, and I'll get my kicks mine.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, I mean, you go into such detail about it in hearing, even about how, whether you use the IN or ING at the end of it, and all the different nuances of it, it's just so, but I love your sense of humor. Your sense of humor is one of the things that I've always loved about having you in our Toastmasters Club, and, you know, you definitely get us laughing and thinking, and I love hearing your stories about your life. It's just been one of the really the most treasured things in my life is having you in our Toastmasters Club and having your sense of humor and your look at life and all of the different things that you've done over the last 98 years. It's just been amazing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talk about the younger generation as though they were just sort of two. Well, when
mm-hmm.
you've been around as long as I have, you're spanning four, maybe. So the differences are enormous.
Oh, I know. I know.
For example, I have said before, you've heard me say it, that I don't think anybody who didn't live through the Depression can possibly understand what it was like, because it wasn't just a downturn in the economy. It's the system was broke and nobody knew how to fix it, and there was no hope. That was the worst thing about the Depression. There was no way out of it. We just mired in it, and it was forever. Also, how different it was in the war years when the whole country was pulling together. Everybody was pulling together, contrasted with now where there's all the anger and the hatred and the backbiting and dangerous stuff that's very bad news for our society.
Mm-hmm.
The contrast with World War II and civility today is just enormous.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that at Toastmasters, and yeah, it's so true. I mean, everything seems to be so divisive lately, and it,
yep.
you know, it'd be really nice.
And that's
if
not
we
good.
No. You know, one of the things that I've always loved about you, too, is that you are so open-minded and you're so curious about life and that you enjoy creativity and you enjoy the differences. And that's, to me, I think one of the reasons that there's problems is that people aren't being open-minded enough to realize that everybody has different viewpoints, but that we can learn from them and we can, I don't know, you know, accept them a little bit more, I guess, instead of everybody saying my way is right and your way is wrong.
Yep. That's why, incidentally, I listen to, I've been criticized by a couple of friends for listening to some extreme right-wing radio talk shows. Mm-hmm. The fact that this stuff, these are dingbats, you know. By my reasoning and standards, they are dingbats.
Right.
But I remind myself that this is the way a third of the country thinks, and you've got to be aware of how other people think and what motivates them. You got to be aware of that. You can't listen. We tend to talk with people who have the same point of view as we do, fellow workers, neighbors, et cetera. Well, hell, we ain't the whole world.
No, it's true, and it's pretty clear right now that there are differing points of view.
Yes, in spades.
Yeah. Well, no, getting back to the war years, and also to that reminds me of, okay, you moved to Hawaii, to Oahu, while you were in college, is that correct? And
that's right.
Yeah, what year was that?
Yeah, my father worked for the Navy, and he was posted to Pearl Harbor. I was in college at the time, and I'd gone through 2 years, and I thought it'd be a hell of a lot of fun to go along and transfer to the University of Hawaii, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for the attack. But the Hawaii before December 41 was really a different world. Margo, you and I have talked about this a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
The Hawaii you love is not mm-hmm. the same Hawaii as I knew, and I'm afraid I'm a bit of snob about the subject, like Marines, an old Marine saying to a young one, you should have been in the old Corps. That's
mm-hmm.
legendary. But it's amazing. It was an island, and so there was very little crime. There was no place to run.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't believe this, but incredible as it may seem, at the Honolulu jail, most of the prisoners were let out for the weekend. shame to have them cooped up. There's no place they could go.
Yeah.
Now, you can't imagine that kind of thing happening today anywhere.
No, that's true.
It was
wow.
a magic place. It really was.
Oh, yeah. I'm never going to be able to go back and experience it that way other than hearing about it from you. And so I've really treasured being able to hear about what Hawaii was like during those times, because the first time Dudley and I ever went to Hawaii was for our honeymoon in 1982. And I will always remember what it felt like just to walk out of the airplane and into the airport and then just see what it was like being in Hawaii. It was just so amazing, the feeling and the palm trees and the smell of the flowers and the
ocean. Air is velvety. The
oh,
air
no.
is velvety, right?
It's just so amazing.
That remains.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of what it was that remains, but I love that you are able to share with us what it was like before as well. And, you know, one of the other things that still remains is them saying constantly, aloha.
Yeah. Yeah,
I love
it's true. The
word
spirit,
aloha.
The spirit of aloha is really still around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's I'm very thankful for that the aloha spirit is still there. And while you're there, it causes you to, especially, maybe not as much on Oahu, although Oahu is a beautiful island, and I'm glad that we've been there a couple times, but also on Maui it and Kauai, it's a little bit slower paced there. And, you know,
Kauai remains my favorite.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I've only been there once,
yeah.
but I will always remember it. But yeah, it just, you know, I think Kauai probably has the closest to the Hawaii that you were talking about, as far as it's not as built up and it's not as commercialized, even though it does have the big hotels there. It doesn't have as many as it does on the other islands.
It doesn't have the smog that Oahu, that Honolulu does.
I don't remember seeing any smog when we were on Oahu last, but I haven't been to Oahu for a while now. I'm trying to remember when it was that I was there last. So, you know, anyway, we're going to run out of time to talk about all the other things I want to talk to you about. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about before we run out of time for sure is your art. So can you tell us a little bit about your art and about how you, why you decided to do it, and a little bit about how it was done? And
well, a few years ago, I got, I've always been a bit involved in art, but a few years ago, I got really intrigued with light and shadow, yin and yang, which led me to start playing with relief, three dimensions instead of two. Mm-hmm. So I found myself settling on wood because it's easy to work, relatively easy to work, and I could take simple shapes, any kind of shapes, and have lots of copies of them. In other words, I deal with dowels, cylinders, things you can buy at a lumberyard, and started assembling these and playing around with, I painted everything white, and I started playing around with lighting these surfaces. And so I developed this body of work, which you have seen much of, mm-hmm. of wall sculptures. They're various sizes, but typical of the kind of thing you would have on a wall, anywhere from 2, 3, 4 feet in either dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And you're painting with light and shadow instead of pigment. It's that simple. And I'm fascinated with the way the highlight changes as it goes around a corner, a sharp corner with a sharp change in shadow, or curved corners where you get this shading from light to dark gray. And so I laid it aside I showed it a few times. I laid it aside and went on to other projects. And then about a year ago, I realized at least most of these things are sitting in my attic. I had no place else to warehouse them. And a couple of people, including you, I believe,
mm-hmm.
talked me into pulling them out and showing them. So I did, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. I had a couple of shows, and they were very well received. And I managed to get my point across to a few people what fun it is to play with light and shadow instead of pigment. So I found it very gratifying, both doing it and response to it.
Well, I love your art. I really do. And I feel so incredibly blessed to have one of your pieces here right in our living room above our TV, the one that you call Blue Line. I think, is it the only one that has any color in it?
Oh, no, there's a bit of color. Color used very sparingly.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's not the
but
only
anyway,
one.
It's in the picture in the slideshow where there's the picture of you and me and the four pieces of art, and it's the top left, I believe, in the slideshow for the people that are looking at the slideshow. But I just love it, and every time people come over, they go, oh my gosh, I love that. And Dorothy from our Toastmasters Club came over the other day, and she goes, Margo, you have an original bin. And I went, oh my gosh, yes, we do. We feel so blessed that we do. And I would love to have more of them if we had more wall space. We just have so little wall space that it would be hard to put more of them up. But each one of them is a blessing. And that one that's with you and Chuck in it in the slideshow that's above your fireplace, I love the way the light of your skylight makes the different lights on that when I'm over at your house. And you're right. I mean, the difference in the way things are lighted makes such a difference.
Yep.
But you used light and dark and shadows and, you know, the whole thing to create. I can't believe how many different ones you have and how creative they are and how amazing they are. And just, that was really fun. I loved your art show. That was really, really fun. And it was so exciting, too, to be there with you for that. Ben, are you still there?
Oh, yes. Just waiting for more.
I just left you speechless. Oh, wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about Toastmasters. I'd like to talk about Toastmasters. And you joined our Toastmasters club, I believe, in 2013. Does that sound about right?
Sounds about right. I have been in several Toastmasters groups before over the years, but I hadn't for quite a few years when I rejoined.
Mm-hmm. And so you rejoined Toastmasters at approximately 92, right? You were 92.
When I was,
Yeah, so, well, tell me a little bit about, I'm not sure I even know the answer to this one, why you decided to join Toastmasters again at 92. What inspired you to do it?
Good question. I'd never asked myself that question before. I guess I think part of it was just feeling I wanted a little more social interaction with people, and I remembered that that was part of my experience with Toastmaster, and so I checked one out and liked it very much. And I liked this club particularly.
Mm.
I think that was it, plus the fact I've always been interested in words. So put those two things together, Toastmaster seemed to be an answer. And I must say I'm awfully glad I did, because I've thoroughly enjoyed this stretch of time with Toastmasters. And I have enjoyed competing, too, particularly in the humorous speech contests.
Oh, I know, and I've enjoyed hearing you compete in the humorous speech contest. I'm starting to laugh just thinking about some of the things that you've said and the speeches you've given. And my favorite of all, though, is the one where you talk about George, the stories of George.
George.
Yeah. Is there a chance that you can give us a little taste of what George is like?
Not really, because what happens with George is I start out by, I'm a guest at whatever or group I'm addressing, a guest speaker, and he's going to tell us about his visit to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And so George stands, I stand up, and I explain that every year when I go on vacation, I like to visit some place I've never been before. And this year I thought, well, golly, why not San Francisco, the city with the Golden Gate? So George starts talking about his visit to San Francisco, and it gradually turns out this man is nutty as a fruitcake. But he moves in on to visit San Francisco. I cast about in my address books to see who I knew that lived. I always prefer to stay with friends rather than the YMCA. Well, bingo. There's my cousin Gladys right there in San Rafael, practically a suburb of San Francisco. Well, he's still an idiot, but then it starts in. You start to realize, wait a minute, he's more than a dingbat. He's a total interferer. The first thing I did was completely reorganize the kitchen. Well, he moves in on their lives, ruins their garden, and he completely misunderstands any criticism and anything negative. He doesn't get it at all. So he's a very funny character, and I enjoyed developing him. I've given that speech not only went up a couple notches in the contest, but I've been invited to give it at other Toastmasters groups. Anyhow, he was fun to develop.
Oh, I love George. I love George, and I love the way you do the speech. And I have to say that, you know, I recorded it on my phone one of the times you did it, the last times at the club. But what's the best is to see the expressions, too. So I think what we need to do is we need to videotape you doing it, because it's not just the auditory, it's the visuals, too, the expressions that George gets on his face.
I guess it would be, yeah.
Yeah, so that's something that
okay,
we need to do.
Okay, feel free.
Hmm?
Feel free to do so. I'll gladly give George a speech for video anytime you want me to.
Okay, well, we'll have to sign you up to do that at Toastmasters.
Okay.
Toastmasters 1441, where we learn while having fun.
Yep.
And boy, do we have fun. You know, I mean, you were saying that you were really glad that you joined Toastmasters, or rejoined it, that is, when you joined our club in 2013. And I can't even believe how long I've been in the club, because I joined it in December of 2004. I walked into the door the first time, and while we were still at Round Table Pizza, and I'm still there, and it's still my favorite place to be on Wednesday nights. It's just, you know, I can't believe how many wonderful, creative, fun people that we meet there, and they all seem to value communication and creativity, and then, like you were saying, the connection that you're able to get by being with these people in a way that you get to know them in a way that you never would any other place. And
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And with ages, all the way from in their 20s all the way up to you, 98, I mean, it's just, I don't know where else you can get that kind of a group. But you had said one of the times that you were talking about your previous Toastmasters experiences were in, like, in a business, in a corporate setting.
Yeah, there is.
How different that is.
That's one of the formats in Toastmasters is a corporate one. It's done within the walls. And as I think I commented at the time, it's interesting. What if your boss has just given a perfectly lousy speech and you have to evaluate that speech? There are pitfalls in the corporate format.
Well, there's that, and which is definitely something to make you think. But there's also the fact that a lot of the Toastmasters clubs meet at lunchtime, and they're in businesses, corporations and businesses. And
yeah,
they have shorter formats, so they have only about an hour. We have a couple hours for ours because it's in the evening. And then also,
you know,
I think a lot of
this, the meetings are strictly organized and ordered. It isn't only here, believe it or not. I went to one in London just for the hell of it,
mm-hmm.
and it was fascinating to watch the same format that we go through, this overlaid in the British caste system, because I'm telling you, they it was like a cookie cutter had been at work. All of the members there, both male and female, were young, British, eager, trying to rise the corporate ladder, and such a totally different kind of, exactly the same format with entirely different cast of characters. That was fascinating.
Yeah, you're making me curious to go to Toastmasters meetings in various locations. One of the things, though, back to the ours being at night, that I love, though, is instead of it being during the day and people talking about their work and presentations, I mean, sometimes people do talk about work that they do at our meetings, but people talk about things that are interests of theirs, and we get a lot of people who are creative artists, authors, musicians, entrepreneurs at our club, and so we have such a wide variety of people and backgrounds,
yeah,
and things that they talk about, and so every week we never know exactly what we're going to be hearing in the speeches and in the table topics and the whole thing. And so it just, you know, every week it's really interesting. And I come home and I go, gosh, I'm so glad I went. And, you know, I really love that. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to have you talk about a little bit, and you did a speech about this at Toastmasters, and it was fascinating to me, is when you were working in the corporation for the design center, the corporate design center, creative design center for the tissue box.
Cyberboard Corporation.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was very interesting. The Fiberboard had this creative design center on the San Francisco waterfront, and we were the major, by far the largest producer of folding cartons in the West Coast. All the stuff you see on supermarket shelves, we made most of the packaging and designed some of it. And my job was to work with the corporations. Suppose we're talking about a manufacturer of some old cake mix or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
To work with their marketing people on what they hope to achieve out of the packaging, and I translate this into a design platform,
uh-huh.
so that the artists sitting at the board don't just make pretty pictures that they enjoy. They are working to a specific set of criteria that I gave them, including things like this is going to end up on the shelf right next to Betty Crocker cake mix. I frequently took an artist with me out to a supermarket and made him look at the context designing into. So I like that aspect of it, turning marketing objectives into design parameters. It was a very interesting translation for me to make. And oddly enough, I managed, in college, majored in economics and minored in art, and I was in effect putting it to work in a way that most people wouldn't have the opportunity to. So it was very interesting work for a long time.
Well, tell us, though, about the tissue boxes, about the chiffon tissues.
Oh, so much is made about the chiffon. It's a long and complicated story I won't bore you with. We did start out with focus interviews, how they feel about facial tissue. Crown Zellerbach had a very limited penetration into the facial tissue market. Kleenex, of course, was the biggie.
Mm-hmm.
And what could we do with packaging? Well, to make a very long story very short, what we did mm-hmm. was design the box to be not to get attention on the supermarket, because up to that time, it was a paper product. It was right along with the wax paper and toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
What we turned it into was a dispenser box for home use. You actually ripped off the name of the manufacturer when you opened the box. And all it took was one gracious packaging on the shelf to make all the other tissue packaging look coarse, vulgar, loud.
Right, exactly.
Well, it only took a couple of years, by the time, I think it was about 2 years, mighty Kleenex had tumbled and now had a dispenser box. Now, this was years ago, but in a matter of just a couple of years, that product went from being screaming boxes in the paper products to all of the packaging now, facial tissue, is one variety or another dispenser package. Now, this isn't earth-shaking, you know, but it was a specific use of design to carry out marketing objectives, and it achieved what Crown Zellerbach wanted. They got themselves, they achieved exactly what they wanted to achieve. They got a big chunk of the market, were seen as a leader. So that's gratifying when you get to work on a project like that.
Well, I remember you bringing in one of the original boxes of tissue.
Yeah, and I told
for
you
one
this
of your
was
speeches.
A historic document.
Yeah, and I loved how, you know, there were, like, I think there was a floral design on the box, and the tissues themselves were pink. And then you said there were also some boxes where it had blue tissues and
five colors.
Five colors.
We used various chrysanthemums in those colors.
Approximately what year would that have been that you designed
those? I don't remember. It's quite a while back now.
Yeah, because I seem to remember seeing colored tissues a long time ago, but I haven't seen them for a long time, so I think that they were around while I was buying
tissues. Oh, no,
I
didn't know that there were fewer colored ones than there used to be, but anyhow.
As far as I know, there's only white now.
That can't be right. I don't know.
Well, I'll have to look in the store and see. I think everybody else is going to have to look and see as well. Yeah. Before I forget to talk about it, I want to talk about what I call your keys to success, which is your key collection. And we have the picture of that in the slideshow. So would you tell people a little bit about why you have that key collection and about it?
Well, my late son was into Victorian stuff, and he had some Victorian keys he'd picked up somewhere, and I thought they were interesting. And but I didn't pay much attention to the subject. And then I was on a trip. I've traveled a lot, and that particular trip involved some time in Iran. And I passed a antique shop that was really more of a junk shop. It was pretty far down the list of quality, elegant stuff. And there were several keys there. And I thought, well, these are too good for the little bastard. I'm going to get some for myself. So that was the beginning. And since then, and then I added locks to my interest as I was shopping for keys.
Mm-hmm.
So from there on, any place I went, I'd look around and see if I could find any interesting locks or keys. And I came across a lot of stuff in India, a marvelous variety of locks. And I got interested in the whole subject and joined the American Lock Collectors Association. And it's so fascinating. You stop to think of it. What do you lock up? You lock up things that are either private or secret. Or valuable.
Right.
So any padlock has a story to tell, really, if you knew what the story was. And I do have a collection out where I can see it. I like, if I'm going to collect something, I want it to be out visible, not hidden away someplace. I want it out where I can enjoy it, too. So I do have quite a variety of both locks and keys, and I find it, and I have found it, and still do, a fascinating subject.
Well,
I remember you enjoyed the display when you saw it.
Yeah, I love it. Every time I come over to your house, I love looking at the keys and the locks and hearing your stories about them. And there's that one lock that had like a secret compartment, I think, in it or something.
Oh,
I
don't
know.
Yeah.
It's pretty
neat,
pretty
stuff.
Amazing. Well, that is part of the whole thing about you loving to travel, which is another thing I wanted to talk about. And so what are a couple of the places that you've really enjoyed going on your travels?
Hard to say, because I've enjoyed all of it so much and for different reasons. One of the places that is less glamorous than a lot I've particularly enjoyed was Belize in Central America. There's nothing glamorous about it. It's a backwater of the old British Empire. It was used to be British Honduras. But I liked so much about it because it is so simple, and it's a fascinating from an anthropological standpoint. The small country, 150,000 people or so, with there are five languages spoken in Belize, and all these people get along just fine. I can talk endlessly about Belize and won't, but I've enjoyed every place I've been, and I'm too old and rickety to travel anymore. Travel is hard work, and a lot of that travel I did and particularly like is kind of rugged. Cruise ships leave me totally bored, and I eat too much. And there's something about a very wise traveler told me once, never travel second class. Everything about second class is tacky. Go first class or third, not in between. And there's a lot of wisdom to that. And traveling, and I had a hell of a good travel agent. This was back in the days when the travel agents really did a job, and the good ones were wonderful, and mine was. There's something about climbing off a train in India or Africa when you've been on the train all night, and you're smelly and feel dirty, and everything has been uncomfortable, and the food, what there was like, it's terrible. You climb off the train in bad shape. That's when you check into the Hilton with white sheets and clean ice and enjoy first class. But never
You know, that reminds me of one of the things Dudley's always said is that contrast creates interest. And, he talks about that in art and design and life in general. But the contrast that you just described is amazing, and it would make you appreciate the clean white sheet so much more after that experience.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is your $2 bills. We got talking about that the other day, and I love the $2 bills that I have that you gave me. And tell us a little bit about
the $2
bills.
I don't know why the government still makes $2 bills, but they do. And a few years back, I got intrigued with $2 bills. Incidentally, a lot of people now don't seem even to be aware that it used to be that a $2 bill was bad luck. If you got a $2 bill and change, it was bad luck, and you had to tear off a corner to turn off the bad luck. Where that tradition started, I don't know, but it was universal. When I was a kid, when you did see a $2 bill, it almost always had a corner torn off. Well, I get $2 bills. I get them hundreds at crack at the bank and put them in the back of the wallet. And a $2 bill always gets attention. And it occurred to me just a few days ago when I was replenishing my wallet, I always have a couple in the wallet,
mm-hmm.
that why I do this, and it occurred to me, I realized that the reason I did was it's a conversation starter. And at valet parking, for example, the guy expects a dollar and he gets a $2 bill, and I always say, you'll have good luck all day. It starts a conversation when you bring a $2 bill into a intercourse with somebody. It starts a conversation, and you know you've got a brief connection with somebody that's a little more full than it would have been without a $2 bill. Well, that may seem like a weird sort of a little hobby. It's been fun. It still is.
Well, I think it's wonderful. And like I said, you know, I still have the $2 bills that you gave me, a couple of them in my wallet. And every time I see those, I think about you and about you giving them to me. And I don't know, you know, I mean, but if it had been a $1 bill or $5 bill, 10, anything else, even 100, I wouldn't know, oh, that's from Ben. So, yeah, it made it extra special to
Well,
me
spend them. Spend them. I'll give you a couple more.
Oh, that is so kind of you. And that's one of the things I love about you, Ben, is that you are loving, creative, and kind. You're all three of those. And I am so glad that I met you thanks to our Toastmasters Club and have gotten to know you so well. And I wanted very, very, very much for my listeners to my Live Your Music show to get to hear about, hear about some of the things that we talk about, you and I. And I'm just wondering if there's any advice that you have for our listeners about living here on Earth.
The best one I can think of, and I don't know who it was, back in the hippie days when gurus were big, Ram Dass
mm-hmm.
and people like that,
mm-hmm.
An awful short line that sums up an awful lot, and that is simply be here now.
I believe that's one of his books.
Living in the moment.
Yeah, be here now.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And, you know, people are talking so much lately about The Power of Now, the Eckhart Tolle book, and all, you know, talking about now, and being in the now. And it really now is the point of power, as Louise Hay liked to say. And it's also now is the only time when we really have to be living and to notice things and to feel joy.
Well, it's all there is. And well, books have been written about this subject, lots of them. But you asked for a single piece of advice, that would be it. It kind of sums up what it's all about, it seems to me. People who live only in the past are boring as hell, and people who live only in the future, they're not interesting to be around much.
You know, you're so
if
right
If they're all
about
always
that.
Waiting for something to happen instead of being in the happening, you know?
Oh, I know. And I've noticed that the more I can be in the now, the more joyful I feel and the more happy I feel and the more I can enjoy the people that I'm with and the animals I'm with and the places I'm in. So, you know, I think that is incredibly, incredibly powerful and good advice for everyone. What else would you say, though? I mean, as far as living your music, what advice would you have for people who want to do something that's scary to them, but they've always wanted to do it?
Well, the answer to that is simple, isn't it? Just do it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Well, what I have
That's one of those things with a simplistic answer. We dismiss simplistic as being, you know, downgrading it somehow. That's really what it's all about. So many things are just that straightforward and that simple. Do it. Somebody, oh, I wish I could something or other. Well, do it.
You know, and that is such a big thing, though, because so many people are afraid to do it, and they think that, oh, I'll wait until the fear's gone. And that's why that book that I really enjoyed called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway got so popular, is because in it she points out that we're always going to feel fear when we do something new. And so if you don't do anything where you feel any fear, you're not going to do anything new ever. And so, but the only way to get past the fear, as she said and as I've discovered, is to do it, as you said, and practice doing it, to, you know, just practice. And that's back to Toastmasters, winding back to Toastmasters. That's one of the cool things about Toastmasters, is that we get to practice every week focusing, being in the now. We get to practice doing things that are scary and letting them get to be gradually less scary and less scary and less scary, and then at some point they start to become fun. And
we are profound today.
Oh yeah. Well, we still have 7 minutes left, and I just would like to say again how much I appreciate you being in our club and being our friend. And oh my gosh, it's just, there's so much joy that you add to to life for me and for Dudley, and you have for Xander, our son, as well. And I know that you do for the rest of the people that are in our club. And it just I really, 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 really appreciate that. And
you just keep that up, and I'll begin to believe it.
Yeah, I know. You just might. Well, that's the thing. If people hear things enough times, they start to believe them. And that's my intention, and it seems to be starting to work. But, you know, an interesting thing that I had asked some of the Toastmasters Club members if anybody had a question for you, and the most interesting one that came up was from Therese Driscoll, and she said, ask him about his parents and the values they imparted. And I started realizing that that's something I didn't know the answer to. So what would you say about that?
I'll pass on that. It was
You'll
all
pass
fine.
On that? Okay,
I'll pass on it. It was all fine, but it's a very complicated subject. I think you do get your basic values at home when you're a kid. And I am grateful for that. My parents were both honorable people. I can't imagine either of them ever doing anything dishonorable. And that wasn't because of lectures. It was just example, which is built in.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's how kids learn, is by the examples that they see. And I've noticed, even in my own life too, I mean, parents can be models of what you do want to do and what you don't want to do. And I mean, you can see things that they do that you want to model, and then you can also see things that you're going, you know, I don't want to do that. And I've had that experience with my own parents, and it's helped me as a parent to start thinking about, what do I want to live as a model for our son Xander? And so, you know, I think that, and it's true with everybody. I mean, everybody that we meet, we're either a role model or a warning to them. And so I think, you know, we just all have to pick what we want to model from people.
And you can't fake it with kids, you know that.
No.
It isn't what you say, it's what you do.
Oh, exactly. I remember when Xander was like maybe, I don't know, whatever age they start talking in full sentences, somewhere between 1 and 2, and his first sentence was, "Mommy, where are you?" And I thought, why is he saying that? And then I started listening to myself, "Xander, where are you? Xander, where are you?" around the house. And so, yeah, it's about realizing that they pick up what you do and not just what you say, but how you say it, which, again, back to communication being so important, is that it's not just the words we use, it's the tone of voice and how we say things.
Yeah.
Well, I have totally enjoyed this time with you, and
we ran through it pretty fast, didn't we?
Well, once it gets started, it goes really fast. We've only got 4 minutes left, and so I just want to say again, thank you, thank you, thank you for all of the things that you have shared with us during the show and also during the time I've known you in Toastmasters. And I have a feeling you're going to be here till at least 105 or more.
At the rate pieces are falling off, I wouldn't expect it.
You know what? You are an example of the TED Talk that's going around recently, or at least I saw it recently, where they said that the top predictor of how long people will live is whether they have a feeling of connection in the world. And by going to Toastmasters, by being someone who's friendly and talking to people in lines and being open to meeting different people and talking to people, making those connections, that's huge. And you're a really good example of that. And like I've said to you many times as I'm driving you to Toastmasters each week, is what's the point of being here if we can't have some fun?
Yeah.
And if we don't have connections with other people. So it's just, you know, I just thankful for Toastmasters. I'm thankful for meeting you through it. And I'm thankful for the fact that it does help us make connections with other people. And I highly recommend, by the way, anybody out there who's ever been curious about it and even knows what in the heck Toastmasters is, that means you probably are meant to try it. So go as a guest to a Toastmasters meeting and tell them Marlo and Ben sent you.
I'll throw one in there too. Google the title of the book. Just Google A Field Guide to the F Word. There's a couple of parts of a major interview in there with the Chicago Tribune that they're kind of fun to read.
Oh, yes, I read that. That was wonderful. And also, before I forget, there's a website that they can check out, and it's in the show information. It's fieldguidetothefword.com. So check that out, everyone, fieldguidetothefword.com. And I highly recommend you get the book. It is definitely a humorous outlook on the work. Ben, thank you for being on my show, and thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Everything. It's been a total pleasure. Bye for now, everyone. Please, everyone, live your music, whatever that is. As Ben said, just do it.
And aloha.
Aloha.
Bye.
Aloha, ha, ha, ha. I love also that you can say aloha for hello and goodbye. So aloha, everyone. Aloha, Ben. Bye.